Okay, hello everybody. Thank you for being here. How's everybody doing?
Pretty good.
Good. My name's Colin Rinesmith. I am a doctoral student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And I'm really honored to have the opportunity to lead this really important, relevant conversation to a lot of the discussion that's been going on here at the conference, building community through broadband media, getting a chance to hear from folks who are doing work in the community around media, building on traditions of this, a tradition of this work here in Chicago and the Chicago area. So I'm really excited to be able to introduce the panel, which I'll do right now very briefly. The format will be pretty much the same as a lot of what you've seen so far. I'm just going to do some brief framing of this discussion. Then we're going to hear from each of the speakers who are going to present. And hopefully we're going to leave plenty of time for Q&A to get everyone in the room involved in this discussion. So from, from the right to left, or this is my right to left, we have Adriana Gallardo from Radio Arte. We have Francis Rome, who has actually been very, showed up last minute because Toby Greenwald, who is supposed to be here, is a new dad, which is really exciting. So thank you, Francis, for being here from Skokie Public Library. And then we have Eitan Michali from We the People Media, the Residence Journal. And at the end, Tiffany Bosley from CAN TV. So we'll hear from all of them today. So getting started, I think this is probably, unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to be here a year ago. There was another session talking about community media at eChicago 2010. But I get the sense this is probably a continuation of the discussion that folks had last year at this time, thinking about, again, how do we connect this tradition of community media to the digital age as people are trying, you know, increasingly creating media, using these tools to create media to share community voices. I think that one of the things that I've appreciated about this conference so far is there's been a really interesting discussion about, well, just prior to this discussion about community archiving, what we're really talking about here in a lot of sense is telling the story of Chicago, right? Of people's voices. When we talk about democracy, diversity in the digital. This is happening here at this event, and that's really exciting to have all these really interesting people, projects to hear, to have them all come together. So again, hopefully this will be an opportunity to share some more voices in this discussion. So very briefly, one of the things I want to argue today is that, and hopefully by hearing from the folks here, we really want to sort of problematize what we, this term community media, what is it? You know, what are we talking about here? And instead of me trying to define that, I think you'll hear from the speakers and they can talk about what they're doing in their communities with media. And I think you'll hopefully maybe get a different sense of what you may have thought community media was. I'm certainly learning in this process, but I think it's much more inclusive, much more democratic, much more diverse than we might have thought. I don't know. This is what we'll see. But I also want to say that it's not new. Community media, people using media in their communities, has a long history. We can go back to the print media that inspired the revolution that led to the founding of this country. Skipping ahead to community radio broadcasting that happened at the turn of the 20th century as radio technology was emerging. Cable access television, in the late 1960s, this was a revolutionary new medium at the time. Folks, activists in the community came together with policymakers, tried to figure out a way to make this medium more democratic, and that's been going on now since the late 1960s. Obviously, libraries have a long history also of promoting and protecting free speech is an integral part of what community media centers organizations do. As the Community Information Services with the Information Referral Services in the 1970s, a great initiative to respond to community information needs. And then you see other examples more recently, like the Independent Media Center movement, protests in Seattle against the WTO sparked this whole new, more democratic, imaginary of what is possible with this technology, broadband, the internet. And that really takes us up to today, I think. And what I'd like to do in terms of this discussion, what we're going to be talking about, and we all had a sort of pre-conference call, sort of, or some of us did actually, to talk about what we would talk about today. And we really want to sort of address what are the challenges, what are the opportunities with broadband technology, given the rich history that we have in our communities as trusted community institutions. How can we build on that and embrace broadband at the same time? So I want to argue that community media today absolutely support democracy and diversity, and in some cases, and in a lot of cases, the digital as well. But I think you'll hear today maybe sort of how the folks on this panel are dealing with the question of the digital. What does that mean? How does that change the nature of the organizations? Is it relevant to the communities they serve? How is it relevant? How is it working? Where are the challenges? These are some of the things that we really want to get at to understand this moment, this broadband moment that I think was addressed a year ago today with the eChicago conference. Again, I just want to, or I want to sort of put out there that I think that the definition of community media needs to be expanded to be more inclusive of a lot of what's going on here at this conference. I think everything that we've talked about has been community media, or a lot of it. And I think we've seen that, particularly at this moment of BTOP and what's been going on with the infrastructure, the funding, the sustainable broadband adoption projects, the public computing center projects. This definition of community media needs to be expanded to include these new emerging forms, these exciting projects, experiments that are happening around BTOP, and I think that's something that is something important to consider. So finally, how are people using community media in this information revolution? If we all agree at this conference that there is an information revolution that's underway, what is the role of community media in this process? And this is really what we want to get at today. So without further ado, I'm not sure if we have any preference on who would like to start first, but I can, let's see, maybe we can start from the folks, the sort of the route that I started with. So Adriana, if you don't mind coming up.
Good afternoon. I'm Adriana Gallardo from Radio Arte, like Colin said. I'll start with a little brief introduction of what the station is, who we serve, what we do, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of this digital divide that is really a huge part of the conversation at our station now. Is to we're a radio station, first and foremost, but we've been training youth in media creation for about 15 years now. And for us, it's always been about the process of training these youth, and now we're seeing that distribution of the pieces that we have is very important, so I'll just get into it. Like I said, since 97, we offered a bilingual Spanish and English youth training program in Pilsen, not too far from here. And at the beginning, it was community students, just from the neighborhood, and now we've expanded to, we have kids from Rockford, from almost from the border of Wisconsin, from East Indiana, that come to Radio Arte for this training. But it's always been a youth-oriented operation, and each year now we're to capacity, over 100 students will come through our doors every year for training. And what this means is that our goals and principles have always been to deliver an experiential learning opportunity, and that's sort of what the founding principles of the station were. The National Museum of Mexican Art bought this Class D license in 97 with no idea what it was to run a radio station. And they just said, well, let's give it to some kids. They'll figure it out. And they did. and then this all happened. And now we're sort of at the point where radio in Chicago, what does that mean? And it's still very powerful to have, you know, 13 miles of the FM radius in Chicago, but we need to reach higher communities. So we'll get into that. But it's primarily been a career training program, and necessarily not just in journalism. It's turned into them, through their stories, being exposed to history, to social work, to sciences, to a lot of different things. So the youth that come to the program know that they're there to learn writing, journalism, interviewing, technical skills. And then what we've seen with tracking alumni is that they go on and become teachers or social workers or activists or, you know, scientists, not necessarily journalists. So we're very proud of that too, because it's sort of a hook, but not necessarily what it means. It's led to tons of civic engagement and things of that nature. And also our goal has always been to build a network of Spanish language youth media, which doesn't really exist in the country even now. It's very hard for us to partner with similar orgs. But we've, you know, over the last 15 years, we have established ourselves as a leader in this type of model of youth training and serving such a niche community, because we've always produced in Spanish and English, and it's always been a Latino-focused radio station. So that's worked out. Who we serve over the years, I mean, they're 70% low-income, 86% Latino, tons of first and second generation immigrants, and now we've, after this many years of doing it, and I don't take claim for the last 15 years, but now we have kids from every generation of the Latino community. So we have some first generation, some zero generation students who are recent immigrants, who this is their training grounds as far as professional skill sets. A lot of them maybe came to the country as teenagers and, you know, aged out of high school and had nothing else to do, and they come here for a professional training experience. A lot of undocumented youth that we serve. And then we have, you know, some seventh generation Latinos who don't speak Spanish, who come to the station, who are looking to produce media. So for us, we have to, you know, sort of find relevant training for all of them and then produce content that reflects the student body, which has been really interesting for us. Let's see. Some of our productions, just quickly, we have six main shows that we produce daily, 1 hour shows, and they each have a focus that the youth have developed over the years. First Voice is public affairs in English. Homo Frecuencia is a LGBTQ youth show in Spanish, first of its kind in the nation. It started 8 years ago and it's been syndicated tons ever since. And it's sort of, it's led to tons of, now we have like a queer prom, we have the Dyke March that came to Pills, like tons of community events that have been linked out of this 1 hour radio show produced in Spanish from the community. Primera Voz is a public affairs in Spanish. Sin Papeles is an immigration focused show in Spanish. Without Borders is its sister program in English, and Q-Phonic is the sister program to the LGBTQ show in English. So we've sort of divided up the content and by language. None of the content is repeated. Each group produces its own content with a similar audience in mind, just the languages vary. And then we also train adults in radio, so that's where tons of the other shows come from, a lot of the music shows that air through the station. The station airs 24/7, so there's tons of content to be filled with. And everybody who produces a show for the station has gone through the training program, as adults or as youth. It's 100% volunteer-based. Nobody gets paid to go on the air, and everybody who goes on the air has been through the station. Just some shows that we have now. Here's sort of like where we begin with the issue of distribution and our signal. So Radio Arte's antenna is in Little Village, where the station originated from, at the Boys and Girls Club. So it's still on the roof of the Boys and Girls Club. Our signal is 13 mile radius from that antenna. So Little Village, back of the yards, pieces of Pilsen get the signal clear. But outside of that community, we get tons of interference and it doesn't sound great. But it happens that Pilsen and Little Village are among the least connected communities, so the radio signal is still very important for the people who do tune in. And we know that radio is highly regarded in Latin America, so people do turn on the radio versus other communities. So for us, it's still a primary tool to reach our audience, even as radio is becoming more relevant and as people don't listen to radio, and the surveys that are published say that communities are not tuning in. We know that Little Village does tune in. We know that the business owners in Little Village still listen to the station. So we have that to think about when we were producing content. Our stream is very strong, and we do get about 80,000 hits, unique hits per month online from all over the world. So people are listening online as well. So that's another audience that we assume is looking for something different than maybe the store owner in Little Village. So we think about that too. We've partnered with Vocalo out of WBZ with an HD signal. We also have an HD signal that plays oldies. We use it mostly to train youth on that station, but with that power, we reach a much bigger audience on the HD signal. So that's been great for us. And then here, the top cities that listen to us online are Chicago, Kansas, LA. Not really a correlation that we can explain, but that's what our numbers are saying. Let me see. So that's the map of the communities that the signal reaches. The dark gray is the main communities that will get it on a regular basis without interference. And now there's a station with our signal in Northwest Indiana that is causing major interference. It's a religious, very fundamental Christian radio station. So now the interference is really, it's a complete clash, and it's the kids really enjoy driving around, and they'll be listening to like LGBTQ issues about like sexual health and freedom, and then there'll be like a cut-in with like a religious like right-wing station. So it's been really interesting with that issue. Like I said, our audience, 76% of our listeners are of Mexican descent, and I think the educational background is pretty interesting. 23% of them have a bachelor's degree, 36% of them attend college, and 30% are in high school. So again, the intergenerational thing is huge for us because it's a wide audience that we're reaching that's quite reflective of our community. So that's what it's one of our founding principles. And again, it's a lot of young people that are tuning in, so that's important to us too. Here, we go into the digital divide. In Pilsen, there's a community center. Well, there's two community centers that offer computer access for community members. One is across the street from us at the Rudy Lozano Library, and there's never a computer open. It's always packed. There's always people there using the computers. The other open lab is in Juarez, Benito Juarez, on Cermak and, what is it, Damon, Ashland, yeah. So those are the two sort of big open labs that the community can go and access. But the community is huge. I mean, we're talking about between Little Village and Pilsen, maybe 500,000 people that need computers or that we're trying to reach. So what our new model of thinking has been is that through our program, we can continue to acquire more computers and sort of maybe create a third community lab in the neighborhood that can serve as a training program and that will be useful to our students, but also open it to the community for them to access the media that we're creating for them. It is not necessarily getting to them, because if we're only creating podcasts now and we're only doing audio slideshows that look awesome on the web but not reaching the people that we're intending to reach. So now we're sort of like thinking, maybe if we get more computers, open it to the community, you know, use that as a pipeline for them to be exposed to our media, maybe that could be something that could help us with this divide. Often the kids that come to the program don't have a computer at home, so these computers are their own, their only access to maybe doing their homework or looking up, doing research, and just now we have the kids on what we're calling a media diet when they go to the computers. Like, you can only play or go on Facebook or do so much for so long. You have to use the computer to its fullest capacity. So that's another like thing. So we open the labs, we have to really be conscious about our purpose and intentional. What we've in talks with the library and the Juarez, the older people that come and access the computers mainly use it to Skype people back home, to email, as a means for them to stay in contact with wherever it is that they came from. So that's been interesting to us. Let's see. Oh, this is messy now. But we use the phone a lot too to reach our audience. So now, people have a fancy phone. They can stream us. They can do all those things. And we also have a phone line that people can call in and listen to the station 24/7. So that's been really effective for us to have people that maybe aren't on a computer or don't have a fancy phone. They can just call this number and listen. And the kids have really enjoyed using that because they can tell anybody to listen to them and they just have to call. And the quality is pretty good, pretty decent. So that's been good. We've also been Ustreaming, and that's been really popular. We just Ustream from our studio, and people can listen there too and watch what's going on. So those are some of the ways that we've been getting creative with reaching. Just some of our results. I won't speak any much longer, but you know, over the years it's proven to be a really important community resource for its airwaves and for the training program. We get kids that have grew up in the neighborhood and walk by the station. I don't know if anybody has ever seen it. It's on a very prominent corner, and we're all glass, so anybody can see the youth working while they're on the air. So a lot of kids have been raised walking by the studios, and now, you know, when they age in, they come by and they begin the training program. So that's pretty cool. Just some alumni voices. For us, it's really important to continue with the career development and youth development aspect of it. And that's why often our distribution hasn't been as strong as it should, and quality doesn't reflect, you know, something that's professional by any means, but that's always because the process for us has been so important, and the youth are learning and the youth are creating and are building community. So we're also trying to make those things and sort of match quality with distribution and now with the web and all these things, sort of juggling a lot of things around. But that's tough. I was talking to Tiffany before this, and there's only 4 people on staff. So when we have to talk about like IT needs, and so you want to produce more media in a computer lab, well, that means that we need an IT person, that means we need to buy licenses, and that means we need, you know, so those are all things that we're facing right now. So let's draw the art in 15 minutes. I'll take your questions afterwards.
Well, I am the accidental presenter today. I am not Toby Greenwald from the Skokie Library. I'm Frances Rame, and my office is down the hall and down the stairs from Toby's. But I hope that we'll be able to get into some things that'll interest you. We're doing a lot in Skokie, Illinois, and I want to, you know, kind of give a shout out for it. Let me get in here. Okay, that's great. Thank you. So part of what I wanted to start with, Toby's not here because he has a brand new baby boy. And Robert Paul Greenwald is in great shape. He did come a little early though, so their family is still kind of stationed around the hospital. They've set up camp there. But I understand he's a voracious eater and really excited to be in this world. He's a great kid. So what I wanted to start with was the idea that we are truly perpetual beta in today's libraries. You know, we forget the idea of the paradigm shift. We passed that a long time ago. It's just that we're always adding in these other things. I mean, we have to rethink what we're doing. We're at its core, librarianship is about connecting people with ideas and information. So we need to be there where the ideas are coming from, regardless of the technology, regardless of the medium. I want to encourage you to think in terms of that, and don't be afraid to learn. You'll hear as we're going forward that I'm not the geek at the library. I'm the content maven and the community liaison. I hang out with people a lot. That's my thing, you know, loving on them and bringing them in and helping to train them. But I don't do the back end of the Drupal work on our website, and I don't work with the media so much, but I work with my teen volunteers who pack a wallop when it comes to that. So it's perpetual beta on building community and making connections in Skokie, Illinois. We have 95 languages that are spoken in Skokie. It kind of fluctuates between 90 and 100 each year, because what we do is take a census in the schools to see what is spoken in Skokie homes. And some of the schools are better than others about making sure everybody turns in the form and we get all of the information. So it's about 95 languages now, 70 cultures. We have all kinds of great folks. We also have 20% of the population, which is a senior citizen, over 60. So it's a very interesting combination of things. I always try to keep things simple because there are language barriers, there are skills barriers, you know, and we're trying to always just move those barriers out of the way, keep it simple and keep it moving along. So I want to also encourage you to be a lifelong learner as a library, just as we encourage the people in the neighborhood to be a lifelong learner. That's key. Getting into our community media, SkokieNet was the first, and that was in 1995, right after the graphical user interface. Some of you know that term, GUI, was invented in none other than Urbana, Illinois, at the University of Illinois. You've heard of Mosaic, the old browser? Yeah, that was it. That was when internet became the rage. That was the start of it all. Once they had pictures and you could just kind of hop from place to place, people said, yeah, I'm in it. This is what I want to do. So we were there a year after that came to be. And it started as a static page, as most other web pages did at the time. It was just like a glorified brochure. You just scan in the information that you'd be handing out to people and pop it up on the internet, and that was it. And what our charge was to go around the community and engage all of the other entities. So we had information about the schools and information about the Chamber of Commerce and information about the churches, organizations, social services, businesses. That was what we were doing, gathering information so that anyone in Skokie could find that information online as well as in a phone directory. How many of you have been in libraries for a long time? Do you remember Rolodexes where you used to keep the local information? Well, this is it. We took the Rolodex and we put it up on the web so that anybody, anytime, anywhere, has 24-hour access. That's the deal. Today, we have a great, wonderfully geeky developer. I mean, his hair is always looks like a, you know, he stirred it with a spoon or something. He's always doing this and thinking about what he's going to do with our site. He's made it so it's on a Drupal platform. It's totally interactive. We get lots of responses from people out in the neighborhood. We get people contributing. We have volunteers. We have some dedicated staff. We have our Skokie Green staff member that's Green Skokie, excuse me. So her focus is always on the environmental issues she hears about, she thinks Skokie would want to know about, all of that kind of stuff. So it's just standard content in some ways, but we also have people's their stories, we have their pictures, we have videos, we have podcasts on the site. And it's a very, very nice interactive space, and people can make comments too. And the idea is, as long as you're respectful, there's a place for you on SkokieNet. So even if you disagree with Bernie or whoever, as long as you just write it respectfully, say this is what happened, or I don't agree with that point of view, and you put it out there. We don't call names. We don't, you know, get in a ruckus. We just say, hey, I have a different point of view, but they're all welcome. We have some awesome volunteers. We have one who's 92 years old, and we say we'd love to have known Marge in her prime, but then think, well, maybe this is her prime because she's pretty darn good. We have a lot of teenagers that we work with. So we just, you know, in everything we're doing, we're building community, we're calibrating and learning technology, seeing where it takes us, you know, what would work well with this website? What are we gonna, you know, what are we doing here? This is the opening page. You can see we have our local bug man is on the front page because he was doing his green presentation at the recent environmental trade show that we had. Just everything you'd want to know about Skokie, Illinois. So that's our SkokieNet. It's been a friend for a long time, and it's a great community builder. Great. We're developing pages in the different languages, some of them. We obviously can't do 95 languages, but we're working on it, trying to get there. It's all about community, our people's space. And this is one of our Holocaust survivors. She is a little sprightly woman, just a wisp of a woman, and came up to me one day on the the reference desk. And she was so charming. I said, well, have you ever thought of sharing your story? She says, oh, I love to write. And she said this in her accent, a very thick Polish accent. And she went home and was writing and brought in this piece in longhand, and it was a story, a vignette from her time in a concentration camp. You know, it brings tears to your eyes. And this is what she had to share. So we've been fast friends. She's in her 80s, but every once in a while she'll bring me another handwritten vignette, and she says, Fran, you have to edit this for me. Well, anybody who knows me knows I believe in editing lightly. We edit for readability. I'm not going to take away anybody's voice. You know, that's your voice is your voice. I'm not all about grammar on Skokie. I'm about people sharing their stories, sharing their ideas. But we do some light editing, but she's brought in several, and she went to visit Poland, and went the first time she'd been there since World War II, since she was released from the camp. And we have that story online too. And she's brought her kids by to visit with us, and she has connected with our teen volunteers, and they went over to interview her. So it gets rich. It's community. It's developing content. We've got a video now of her, and she's since connected with the school kids and is telling her story with them. She'd been quiet for many years, and this was like the spark that got her thinking, got her writing, and reminded her that, as she says, she has an obligation. So this is our Skokie Net, and it's all about community, good information, plus people and their stories, and the dynamic that is our space. A couple of years ago, we decided we wanted to do some more targeted services online too. And so we got our heads together and put together what we can call our business portal. This is for our business community. It's chock full of all those pieces that people don't normally use. The wonderful databases. You know, you're always saying, we've got these wonderful databases. Here, come and use these databases. We get those. We have those on the page. We've got information about what we do in our library, all of that. And right now, we're also pulling through the voice of the people. We have our SkokieNet directory for businesses that we've pulled through. We're getting the blogs and the events of interest to the business community, so we'll make it so that's going to be the face for the business community, which includes part of community stuff and part of library stuff, but it's targeted, focused on them. And we're going to see it. You know, maybe that's something we'll be doing more of in the future. We're not clear on it, but it seems to be working. Our Skokie Talk channel on YouTube has been in place over 3 years. We just found out this year the Cable Commission is doing away with their annual competition for awards because our kids won it 3 years straight. So you'll see all of their stuff up there on that. I don't have much time. I've been babbling on. Forgive me. Facilitating creation. We're now getting into, we have a digital media lab, which is great. One of our kids pulled all of this together. Isn't that a great cartoon? I think these slides will be available so you can read them. But that was great. And we have only one locked door in the building, and that's it. So you have to go to the computer lab, get the key card, and go in and you know, make your magic, either music or videos or your artwork, whatever. We have 4 Big Macs. We have a green wall, which is a hoot. The kids love to play around with that. And it gets to be a hopping place. We have stuff people can check out to go home. You've got a flip cam or an MP3. You just go out and you gather your friend's stories, or spend the day at the zoo or wherever, bring that back, pull it together, and pop it online. We have a page of stuff they've created, so you might want to go online and see it. Our most recent thing is Skokie Stories, where we're actually going and interviewing people out in the neighborhood. This is my friend Sunil Chatterjee, who was born in Burma of Indian parents, and what he's been through in his life. It's quite an interesting story, if you have a chance. Just a great story. And we're trying to get the ideas to get people to, it's not just the librarians doing it, it's people interviewing one another. you know, go interview your family member or your neighbor, interview people in your club, just get to meet people and go from there. And so we go. I wanted to leave you with just this quick little, if it'll play. We have sound?
Yes.
Okay. I don't think this came up. I don't think it came up. On Rosh Hashanah this past year, the Westboro Baptist Church came to Skokie, Illinois, and they visited, the day before they'd visited the, I don't know if you've heard of Westboro Baptist Church, those are the people that picket. Those are the people that go around and picket. They don't like gay people, they don't like people who are Jewish, but they have a very, very skinny frame of reference about human beings. They just don't like a lot of people. On Rosh Hashanah, they showed up at Niles West High School, and the kids, although it was their day off, 150 of them came out, and I just wanted to show you briefly what they put together with this video. It's very short and sweet. They never engaged with them. They let them be down. There were six people from the church, and I understand there are never very many. That might be the entirety of their group. They had their signs, and they're very skilled with it. They had signs. They could stand like this, and they'd have signs up here and two more hanging down from their elbows. They even had a child who was with them to say, well, we don't like gay people, and we don't like this stuff. But the kids were phenomenal.
Hi, I'm Eitan Michaeli. I am the executive director of We the People Media. We are a Chicago-based not-for-profit organization. We train low-income adults and youths as journalists, and we have them produce their own media, and we put it up primarily through the internet today, but I'll just go into a little bit of background about our history and tell you kind of where we are today. But before I start, I just want to recognize my board president, Colonel Eugene Scott, is sitting right there in the third row. Colonel Scott, in one of his many functions, runs the Bud Billiken Parade every year, which, if you know, the parade is really one of Chicago's most spectacular events, warmest, family-friendly events that you could ever hope for. Also want to say how impressed I am with the Skokie Public Library and everything that you guys are doing. I should, in the interest of full disclosure, say that I'm also very, very impressed with Radio Arte and with CAN TV, who are both longtime partners of ours in the work that we do. And you know, these are all tremendous folks who really do a great job in their respective fields. So We the People Media is 15 years old this year. We got started in 1996, and at the time we were a print publication that was written for and by public housing tenants in Chicago. I was a reporter at the Chicago Defender newspaper covering public housing, and it was obvious to me that with the exclusion of the Defender and a few other news sources, there really was not very good news coverage of public housing communities, which is to say that there wasn't a lot of accurate, relevant information being produced about these communities. That if you were a public housing resident, there really were just very few places for you to go to get the information that you needed to participate in our democracy, to access social services, and otherwise to be a part of society. The Chicago Housing Authority initially funded the Residence Journal with a written agreement to the editorial independence of the publication. We had a charter from the resident leadership, so it was really a joint effort. And I have to give credit to the CHA. They respected our editorial independence for the first 3+ years of our existence. And then a new administration took over at the CHA with a very different vision of what it meant to have an independent news organization in their midst. They offered us the chance to be a part of their public relations operation, which we declined. And we broke off and formed our own not-for-profit organization, We the People Media. At the same time, concurrently really, the CHA began this project of demolishing all of the city's public housing developments and with the ostensible promise that they were going to replace them with mixed income communities. What's actually happened, if you know the situation, is that almost all of the residents have moved to other low-income neighborhoods just south and west, really, of where the developments were. The CHA's own data bears this out. This isn't no longer kind of a controversial opinion, although it was years ago. And essentially, the former residents have moved into a much larger community of people who also face a dearth of relevant information from the news media. They also don't get covered unless there's, you know, a tragedy or some sort of awful crime that takes place. Their average needs, their daily accomplishments, these are all things that really are not covered in the news media. So we, after much soul searching, decided that it was important to really expand our mission. We had thought maybe we should just go softly into the night, maybe we should become kind of a tool to mesh the new mixed income communities that the Housing Authority was pulling together. These were all things that we discussed, but what really came through was that there was a large population, much larger than the population of folks in the CHA, who were not getting well covered by the existing mainstream media. And so we really decided that we had to expand what we do and really reach out to this population. And just to give you a sense of how large the population is, the overall population in the Chicago Housing Authority was never more than 200,000 people altogether. All right. The population today of people who live below the poverty line in the city is 600,000. There are 200,000 people in the city who live in families. So we're talking primarily, usually a mother and children. There are 200,000 people who live in families whose incomes are less than $10,000 a year, annually. Right. So these are the figures that we're dealing with. That this is not a well-known statistic, even though it's census data that's universally available, suggests, I think, that the mainstream media really does not cover poverty as an issue, as an ongoing crisis. And that's something that we really do at We the People Media. We are very much concerned with poverty as something that can be solved in this country, at least ameliorated. We definitely believe that you can raise the bottom in this society and make the lives of low-income people much easier. Of course, healthcare is a part of it, decent education, public safety, and housing. Housing is, of course, a main issue that we have quite a bit of expertise that we've accumulated. Now, I'll just say a few more words about We the People Media. It has been a very, very successful effort to open the doors of professional journalism to low-income people. We have created national award-winning journalists through our work. We have won awards from the National Society of Professional Journalists, the local Chicago Headline Club, the local branch of the National Association of Black Journalists. It has been a really successful effort that I think is also due to the openness of the news media to allowing new voices to come in as long as they respect the rules of how journalism is done. In other words, you don't need a PhD or a degree in medicine to be able to practice journalism. Journalism is something that is a small d democratic activity and something that you can do. And we have proven it that anybody can really come and learn the principles and provide news and information and get recognized by others in the field. Last thing I'll say, I think maybe before I just be quiet and kind of let other things come out maybe in questions, is the movement toward becoming an online presence. It's something that's been deliberate for us and frankly something that we talk about and even argue about on a daily basis. We still get requests every day for the print edition of Residence Journal, right? Which was a publication that we published essentially up through 2000, the end of 2010, on a regular basis. At that point, we had a grant, 10 years of support from the MacArthur Foundation, which ran out. I'm nothing but thankful to the MacArthur Foundation for that support. If you know how foundations operate, 10 years of support is a long time for a foundation like MacArthur, so I really do appreciate their support. But it ran out, and that forced us to really evaluate whether we could continue doing a print publication. Even though we still get requests for the print publication, the cost of it just became prohibitive. And there are a lot of indications that it is a good time for us to go online. We know that our population is moving very, very quickly to get online. I'll just give you a couple of quick anecdotal data points, although I'll say that I don't think that there's been very good research, particularly about the numbers of low-income people that are closing the digital divide and the current state of the digital divide in Chicago. We're doing some of that research ourselves with limited funding and limited resources, but we're doing some of that work ourselves, and we will be documenting it and putting it out, and so I encourage you to check back on our website and look for that kind of data as it comes out. But I'll just leave you with a couple of data points that I think will be helpful. About a year and a half ago, the Housing Authority had to deal with an issue that came up because a text message, apparently with some erroneous information, started to go around, which indicated that if you showed up at the Charles A. Hayes Family Development Center, which happens to be where we're based, on a certain day, you would be able to sign up for the CHA waiting list. Okay? So the text message went out, and we know that there were thousands of people lined up this day, all the way down from 48th and Wabash to 47th and Michigan, right, to get onto the CHA waiting list, right? Now, the CHA, 8 months or so later, did open up their waiting list to the general population to get people onto the waiting list. There's a chance for 40,000 families to get on the waiting list. The Housing Authority wanted to do this process online. Because they've received some criticism from us and others over the years of not making things accessible, they made a really good faith effort, to their credit, to put staff in public libraries, they opened up 40 workstations in the Hayes Center and in other places to let people come in and sign up for this waiting list online. They got almost no response to the people coming into the public facilities, to the libraries, to the Hayes Center, to other places. They got a trickle of people, maybe around 300 or 400. They did get 200,000 people signing up for the 40,000 spots on the waiting list. Now, that's a sad story on the one hand, because it means that there are 200,000 families in the city that need housing, right? That's something that we should all be concerned about. But it also means that those 200,000 families were also people that were adept enough to be able to go online somewhere, somehow, through a friend's phone, their own computers at home, or some other means, to be able to register and get onto the CHA site. Last thing I'll leave you with is that there is a Facebook page for Robert Taylor. Now, Robert Taylor, of course, is the public housing development on the South Side that hasn't existed since 2006. But there are today more than 5,000 members of this online Robert Taylor community. And the conversations are very rich for anybody that's interested in the power of that community, anyone that respects the sense of community that the folks there built up. And certainly there's a lot there for anyone to try to get an understanding of how everybody is reconstituting their identity online. Okay, so thank you very much. I will look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Tiffany Bosley. I'm the Nonprofit Services Manager at CAN-TV. CAN-TV stands for Chicago Access Network Television, and we facilitate 5 non-commercial PEG channels, which you can view on any basic cable package in Chicago. Those channels are 19, 21, 27, 36, and 42. PEG, which is Public Education and Government Programming, is one of the most significant public benefits that's come out of cable franchise agreements in Chicago. We serve a whole host of different people in Chicago. In essence, we serve any Chicago resident or any Chicago-based nonprofit. Specifically, we serve over 26 different ethnic groups in Chicago. We work with both seniors and youth. We partner with nonprofits, big and small, government agencies. Labor unions have been very participating very much with CAN-TV. And we also partner with different schools, universities, and training centers. And especially around election time, we have many different elected officials who come in and utilize CAN-TV to get their message out to their residents and their wards, really, the aldermen in their districts. We basically give a voice to the voiceless by providing them with a video production training where they can create their own video programs. They can submit programmings to us if they have their own equipment. If they don't have their own equipment, they have access to our equipment. They have access to our studios and our editing suites as well. We also have a small team that does go out and cover local community events with No Slant, and we will cover the full program. It will not be a 60-second soundbite on the news. And we also provide promotional services to nonprofit organizations. These services include a bulletin board channel where nonprofits can recruit foster parents. They can promote a upcoming community health fair. They can announce programs for light and energy assistant programs and different things like that. They can tell their success stories with a kind of a computer-generated channel, cable channel 27, where we put together stories from nonprofits that shares the success that they have. And in turn, they can share those videos with their donors and with the people who they work with. And then we also do a live call-in talk show with nonprofits. And you can think of that as talk radio, but it's televised. And it's just an opportunity for the nonprofits to come in and give out the content. And we do all the technical part for them. So the only thing that they have to worry about is the content. And viewers can call in with questions. It's a great way to connect directly with Chicagoans at home, especially when you're giving out information regarding public health information. We do a show, HIV, AIDS, call in live, and that's basically where different community-based organizations come in. They give out health information about HIV and AIDS and STDs, and someone who's watching the show can call in anonymously and ask a question that may be hard for you to ask when you're face-to-face, and they can get the answer to that question. But not only that, they can then connect directly with that nonprofit because it is a local nonprofit in the community. So with the high-speed internet access and the increase with people using video sharing sites and social media, this presents an opportunity for CAN-TV to kind of help our nonprofits use the web as another platform to extend their message out to. And we surveyed, I'm going to focus on our nonprofits since that's the department I work with, but we did survey our nonprofit members, and we found that 92% of them did have high-speed internet access. So we knew that that wouldn't be an obstacle for them. And they were mostly using email, social media, and their own websites to do most of their outreach and education. And the people that were doing that outreach and education were the program staff within these nonprofits who worked directly one-on-one with the individuals that they serve. So these were not communication professionals. These were not marketing professionals, which means that they lacked the training and the know-how in terms of extending their message in terms of video to the web. And when we asked them what their primary obstacle to posting their content that they created to CanTV online, what they told us was that they didn't have the staff time or the skill to do it. So we saw that as an opportunity to provide training to them to help them do just that. But and what we did was we started a pilot project. And this pilot project, we are working with an AmeriCorps member who has developed curriculum to help our nonprofits take their show and put it online, but do it strategically and do it so that it can be effective. But some of the questions that came from that and some of the challenges that we face is this notion that cable may be outdated. And PEG, is there any value in PEG when you have a YouTube, YouTubes of the world? And we want to kind of dispel this myth and let you know that online video streaming accounts for less than 2.5% of the total video consumption across all demographics. So TV is still the screen of choice when it comes to video for people. And we think of online method is just another tool in a toolbox for our nonprofits to reach a wider audience. The other thing is PEG. It's important to have a PEG center because when we did these trainings with the nonprofits, we found that we did two different things. The first thing we did was we worked with the group and we talked to them more about strategy. And we told them to, we linked them to some online sites where they can find out and watch an online instructional video of how to upload, how to post it to your Facebook page, different things like that. The nonprofits really took on to the strategy part, but when it came to the actual technical uploading and watching the video, they really struggled with that. And they really found that it was, they needed to have someone holding their hand along the way, watching them step by step and showing them how to do it all along the way. We also conducted a community needs assessment where we found that 3/4 of cable subscribers who are registered voters think that CanTV is very or somewhat valuable to the community. So people still find value in PEG access centers. The same thing with internet users, about 75% of those cable subscribers who access the internet think that CanTV is somewhat or very valuable to the community. And that 85% of cable subscribers who are registered voters feel that it is either somewhat or very important that residents have access to a local facility for video training and equipment. So I would argue that PEG is not outdated. It is important to have a training facility here, and it's important to have a place where people can get access to the equipment so that they can create their content. Some of the other questions that we got is, well, once that program is online, who's watching? No one, the nonprofits came back and said, well, okay, we have our show online, but no one's watched it. So it's kind of like, okay, it's on YouTube, now what? And we really had to sit back down with them and go back to our fundamental process, which is basically taking the nonprofits through a needs assessment where we say, okay, what are your communication goals? What is it that you want to accomplish? And then we look at everything in the toolbox and we say, okay, well, in order to accomplish that goal, maybe you should use our bulletin board channel. Maybe you should use the web. So the web is just another tool in that toolbox. The other things in to thinking about that, some of the groups and the digital vibe may not be online. So if you're looking to reach some of the people that are represented in that digital divide from the nonprofit point of view, going to the web may not be as effective for them. Cable may be just as good for them, or even better, to reach the population that they want to provide. So in essence, what we feel that there is a great opportunity to facilitate nonprofits and the Chicago residents in putting their in extending their content online, but it's not, it doesn't take over PEG. It doesn't take over the existence of the cable channels. It's just an extension of the cable channels. And we don't see commercial, we don't see MTV shutting down the channel and having everything online. They run their programs on their channel, and they and whatever they do is an extension. And we want people to look at PEG centers in the same way. Whatever we do online is an extension of the programming that are running on our channels as well. And so if you all were interested in learning more about some of the programs we put on, programs are from the people in the community, please sign up for our program highlights. You can go right to our website at www.cantv.org.
Great. Let's thank all of our panelists one more time. That would be great. And we have about 10 minutes for questions, so now's the time. If anybody has any questions that they'd like to ask or learn more about some of the projects that these good folks are working on. If not, I'll ask questions. But yes.
So
I think we're going to need, if you don't mind, if folks can use the microphone, that'd be great. Thanks.
So we have a brand of public television downtown in our town, and they do not nearly as much stuff as kids. And I think there's a lot they can learn. And so if you had a public television channel and they wanted to pick up some of the programs and ideas that you have, are there any guides or what would you have to say? Are there things
where
you can provide for us? Urbana Public Television, so Urbana Champion.
Okay. In terms of starting?
In terms of, so they have a program that's this sort of classic program. They're not doing things like promotion for nonprofits. They there's not a lot of posting online. They basically have two people and that's all they've got funding for.
Okay.
So, but I think the kinds of programs you're doing are great. One of the big preventions from getting them, besides finding the people, would be knowing how to do it. And so that's one of them.
And what we've done for the nonprofits especially is not only knowing how to do it, sometimes they just don't have the time to actually learn the technical aspects of it. So we kind of center it on what they do best, which is the content. Which is, if they're doing outreach, they do that every day in their day-to-day work. It's such an extension of it. So what we do is just say, hey, you come here for half an hour and you do what you already do in the office. You do this public education, but you just do it in front of a camera. And you have your program that way. So I would just make it as easy as possible for them and try to take away any obstacles or as much obstacles as you can for them. And maybe Eton can talk about it more because we do partner with his organization. So he can kind of tell you more about what makes CanTV good for the nonprofits.
For those who have very, very limited television production skills, meaning me and my staff. Even though we're print journalists, we really don't have any television training or skills. These guys make it pretty much foolproof, which is good for, you know, fools like us. We go into a room, we sit for our live call-in program, we go into a room, we sit down at a couple of pre-stationed chairs, and they already have the cameras focused. They have pretty simple instructions how to screen calls. It really is a nice partnership where they've set it up so that we can't mess up the production, but we can provide content and take people's calls and really get a good community dialogue.
Yeah. Actually, if you could say your name and where you're from, that'd be great.
I'm Jared Dunn. I'm from Dislist at UVI. I caught on to what Francis said about how they sort of got a story from the reference desk. I thought that was interesting. Your Holocaust survivor came to the reference desk and that sort of translated into a story on ScopeNet. So I was kind of interested in how all of you integrate sort of the physical and social space that you work in with your media work and sort of make those two things work together and, you know, do outreach. Content and stories to filter up into your organization and your work.
So, and actually, if we can use the.
Hearing the question before you respond.
Yeah, he's wondering how we all, I guess, find the time and the wherewithal to do outreach with what we're doing, right?
I think it was maybe specifically around how you use it physical space. Is that
how you
physical space?
How you integrate what you're doing with institutions or with neighborhoods or with all those things and then make sure that those connections are maintained and happen.
Well, I'm all about outreach, and I had one colleague joke about my reference skills one day in class. By the time we finished with the, our interaction, I had hooked the individual up with the children's department. I had hooked him up with the Chamber of Commerce. I hooked him up with some other organization and was talking to him about some other thing that he was involved in. Because I think at its core, librarianship is about people. And it's about connecting to those people and connecting to their needs and connecting them to the information and the resources and the other people to expand their worlds. So it's just kind of something I do.
For us, the physical space is really, it doubles as a community center too. So we'll host community meetings. We'll have, tonight there's a play going on by some park down the street. So we stay relevant by opening the space to anybody who needs it, not just the kids that come through the program or the teachers or things like that. So, and also like I mentioned before, we're on a very prominent corner of the community. So we're physically present there too. I don't know if that answers your question.
Another question?
Yes, I have a question for WRTE. Who assisted you in obtaining the low-power FM license?
Well, that was probably back in the day. From what I know, the Quakers owned the license before we did, and they were the ones trying to get rid of it, and somebody called the president of the museum, the National Museum of Mexican Art, and said that this Class D station was up for sale. And he said, well, what if we don't buy it? Who's going to buy it? He said, well, the Quakers would find somebody else to keep it. And he was like, we can't let that happen. And that's how it happened. Legally, I don't know how we mediated it or whatnot, but that's
So is your station housed in the museum?
No, we're a couple blocks in front of the museum,
okay.
East. We're on 18th and Blue Island. The museum's on 19th and Damon. So we're not in the same building. And the antenna is a little village. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
And if you are interested in learning more about low power FM radio and how to obtain a license, because there's an incredible opportunity right now with a recent act that was passed in December, the Prometheus Radio Project at prometheusradio.org is a fantastic resource. They would love to talk with you about how to start a radio station if you're interested. And actually, in the last couple of minutes, I'd also like to point to another really important report that was recently released by the Benton Foundation. Charles Benton is here in the room from the Benton Foundation to provide also some context in terms of this broadband moment that we're in and what the costs are, what the stakes are for traditional community media centers, organizations like the folks who are represented here. The report found that over 100 public, educational, and government access television stations have closed over the past 5 years alone. As a result of a number of different things, some of it, a large part of it, has to do with statewide franchising, laws that have been passed in a number of states across the United States, also the economic situation that we're in today. Having policies to support community media across the country are extremely important. This is an opportunity for all of you, for all of us, to create a more democratic media system, but we need to participate in that process. Places like the Benton Foundation and other organizations, including Prometheus Radio Project, provide that opportunity to learn more about how to get involved in media policy to create and sustain a more democratic media environment. So I just wanted to end with that idea that we all need to come together, and we really need to work together to preserve and support this incredible work that's being represented here today by the folks on the panel. I just want to thank everyone here again, and to thank all of you for being here.
I just wonder if I could ask another question.
Oh, sure, we have
one more question. I just wanted to make a sense, especially from the community media in Chicago, if you all doubled or tripled or quadrupled your broadband pipe availability at your home offices, what would you all do with that? How would that impact what you do now?
When you say pipe, what do you
mean? I mean, in other words, if your broadband speed increased exponentially, doubled or tripled, what would you do with that?
We would love to archive more of what we produce, increase that capacity and be able to hold it. Also, we'd like to not use third party streaming and host our own media like any other station. Like what Tiffany said too, we're doing more video work, that would help us a lot too. Those are sort of like just off the top of my head. I'm sure our IT guy would have like a party with your question on it.
Anyone else want to jump in on that?
Not Chicago.
Please.
Well, you know, I'm so excited about these BTOP grants because this is the first time that everybody in the state practically will have access. Of course, we'll be able to do a lot more medical records. We'll be able to, you know, people sitting in a library would have access to all kinds of video resources. This is education. I mean, this is a great time for us.
brought as a result of ubiquitous, easy, broadband or faster access. Those are the kind of changes we're talking about, and I think we need to move in that direction faster, even faster.
Okay, with that, thank you all very much.